Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
I was just thinking about, you know, the Vesica pieces, or also Venn diagram, you know, when two circles overlap, but that's where we want to go, right? It's into that fish, which is an opening of where your and my experience and even psyches overlap.
Okay.
Which is not a rational thing, like, oh, well, we have these tastes or these, but we can also kind of make a few guesses as far as where to start. The obvious one to me has to do with family history, formative experiences, imprints, early imprints, individuation, becoming aware of the ways in which we are not ourselves, the somatic elements of that, like how it's a bodily journey more than a mental one. Coming spontaneously, but it sounds about right.
Yep.
In terms of, like, we have an agreement about that based on the shared experience, I would say. Would you agree?
I would absolutely agree. There is a common, if I use the phrase, psychological history in our experience with life.
Right.
There's some overlap there for sure.
And I'm 48, I'm about to be 49, I think. I might have to check that. I tend to anticipate a year ahead, but anyway, I'm either 47 or 48 right now. And you are?
About to turn 55.
Right, same age as my sister, who is also here, did the last podcast. I remember you saying, I guess the first and last time I met you, I think it was then, maybe it was in an email, that you had only recently begun to experience joy.
Yes. I began to experience joy, became aware that I was experiencing joy for the first time in the early part of 2014. And it was an interesting discovery, because it was this strange feeling I couldn't actually place. It took me about 2 weeks to figure out that what I was experiencing was joy.
Hmm.
I don't know what else to say about it, but
mm-hmm.
And the funny thing about that is that some people say, well, how do you know the difference? And for people who've probably been joyful in their life or had a joyful life, there's probably no way of telling them what the difference is.
The difference between not feeling joy and feeling it?
Correct.
That's an odd question.
Yeah, it is. Because I think one of the things that happens when you're not aware that, or when you're not feeling joy, is that you mistake pleasure or happiness
mm-hmm.
for joy. And they're not the same thing.
Right. Yeah, I would, at this stage, I would be inclined to say I'm not sure if I have experienced joy. I would also be inclined to say yes, I have, but it would be very hard for me to pinpoint. Like, I could refer to experiences on psychedelics, I would discount those. I could refer to sexual experiences, I would discount those. I could refer to experiences of euphoria, I would also tend to discount those.
Yes.
Because of ego inflation.
Correct. They're not the same thing.
Right.
And I've experienced that very, very clearly with when I was awarded publicly for best student. That's when I remember what the feeling of euphoria is about, because it's quite a wonderful feeling when you have 800 or 1,000 people standing up and cheering you on when you don't feel that you really deserve to be there. And so the feeling of euphoria is not joy.
Mm-hmm. So you were specifically talking about a feeling of euphoria that was accompanied by a feeling of not deserving.
Correct.
So what about an experience of euphoria where you did feel that you deserved it?
I've not experienced that because I've never actually felt deserving of anything particularly. Perhaps the feeling of joy, now this has just come up because of the conversation, is actually relaxing away from this notion of deservedness.
Mm.
And recognizing that it's enough just to be.
Mm-hmm.
I know that for myself in the last three or four years, I've really become aware of how pernicious the idea of deservedness is, not from just a personal level. I was originally thinking of it from a economic and a social level, is that the idea of deservedness allows us to let people die and close our eyes to it as undeserving. All we have to do is categorize someone as an undeserving person for whatever reason, and then we can let them die or we can kill them. But I think maybe that outward view of deservedness and its cruelty, in a sense, I've relaxed that. Maybe that's when I began to feel joy. I'm going to have to think about that. That's a very interesting thought. I hadn't made that association. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I wasn't doing things, so I can't really accept the thank you. But so there's two things in that. One is the main thing about the deservedness of or the lack of joy being a spontaneous thing that arises internally as opposed to a reaction to something that's happening external, perhaps would be a way to sum up why I'm feeling my way around that. And if I were to try and refer to experiences where I might have experienced joy, they would probably be very subtle. They'd probably be easier to describe. I'd be more comfortable describing them as well-being.
Yes.
So very subtle sense of contentment that is in the body and that is very deep, a very deep sense of well-being.
Yes, you're approaching what I experience joy as being. And I'm not going to say that I've been joyful the entire time since I've experienced joy. I'm still struggling with my own issues of deservedness and my own internal demons. But the feeling of joy is definitely more present and more solid as time goes by. So when I first experienced joy, it was this like a surprise of, oh my God, this is what I'm feeling. And then it faded away for a while. I went back to some of my own patterns. But the patterns weren't as deep. The joy is now kind of there, just not quite high up.
So is it not, there tends to be an association, I think, between joy and ebullience or exuberance. Like it's a big expression, joyful.
Yes.
You don't seem to fit that idea of joyful, as in you're not bouncing around like Tigger.
Yes, that's unfortunately a challenge of language. Joy for me in this case here isn't so much ebullience or dancing, which I've discovered I love to do, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
Joy is more a sense of complete contentment with being where you're at, who you are, and with the people you're with. It's just a complete awareness that that is absolutely the right thing to be.
Mm. So then I'm getting the sense that joy is actually almost like the opposite of ebullience and bouncing, because it's like deep relaxation.
Correct. That would be my definition of joy.
Deep relaxation?
Yep. You're absolutely relaxed in the moment.
Right. So that doesn't fit with our expectations about what joy is,
no.
Which is closer to euphoria,
Yes.
And I think what you're saying about euphoria made me realize that euphoria, for me at least, is often related to or synonymous with intense satisfaction.
Yes.
So if I feel I've done something or I'm getting credit for having done something, there's a feeling of yes.
But that's the ego speaking, and that's not joy.
Right. But that, so then satisfaction, like the song, I can't get no satisfaction. He's describing all the things that don't satisfy him.
Yes.
So if we associate satisfaction, as I think we do, with something that is a response to something outside of us, even if it's emotional satisfaction, but certainly sexual satisfaction, financial satisfaction, or creative satisfaction, maybe creative is a bit blurry there, that's back to the deserving. Like,
yes.
Is my output deserving of what I get coming back?
Yeah, encomiums. Do you deserve encomiums?
What's that?
Encomiums of praise.
Hmm.
Right. So if in fact you're... through all my various bits of reading that I've done, one of the common themes in the various philosophies of all sorts that I've read, from Taoism to Buddhism to Carl Jung to whatever,
mm-hmm.
one of the ways in which you become joyful is by not having the ego respond to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that means respond in a positive way as well as a negative way.
Right.
Joy comes from relaxing the ego enough that the inner spirit or inner creative energy or whatever it is that makes us who we are at our core has its quiet place. If the ego is responding to stimuli positively or negatively, that's not joy.
Mm-hmm. So the ego... at least there's... my sense of the ego is that it depends on stimulus.
Yes.
So if you're talking about the ego developing a non-reactive mode, let's say, I think that's what you're talking about.
Yep.
It seems as though the ego would become less and less present.
Yes.
If it didn't have things to respond to, good or bad.
Correct.
So then something else moves in.
Something else moves in. And I think Jung described this through the persona and the individuated self. Right. So the individuated self, the persona disappears. And the persona is not necessarily equated to the ego, but the two are interlocked in some manner.
Right. So this is back to what we were saying before we started, which is everything's a performance. And then you say, well, hopefully the performance is authentic. And I said, well, it would be getting past performance then, like there's no performance if it's authentic. If there's no persona, there'd be no performance.
Correct.
So then what's interacting with the world?
And this is one of the great mysteries. This is the current issue that I'm reconciling with or dealing with or wrestling with is reconciling of the opposites. Right, so how can there be nothing and something at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
How can the ego not exist and yet us able to perceive the world as if the ego existed?
Yeah, to move in it at least.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't have a good answer for that.
Uh-huh.
I'm wrestling with that. But when I attended your shadow workshop, I forget the exact name of it, one of the things that stood out for me in the discussion was the fact that the younger people, I'll call them younger people, mm-hmm. I think I was probably the oldest one there.
Yeah.
Yeah. The younger people, and there's some young people there, all of them felt somewhat intimidated, I'll say. I'm putting my language on how they introduced themselves and some of the ways they discuss things. They felt a bit intimidated to be in public, in a public sphere, talking about not necessarily personal things, but we'll say unconventional and perhaps even somewhat sacred things. And so it made them uncomfortable. And one of the things that I realized in that discussion for myself, and in watching the various people introduce themselves is that I felt completely natural and at ease being there. And so for me, there was no, or very little perhaps, I won't say no necessarily, but there was very little notion of me being there to perform. I was there to experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no fear about that experience. And I think that's the difference between having the ego involved to a certain extent and or the persona involved.
Mm-hmm.
Is,
yeah,
it wasn't there for me, I'm going to say. My own perception, but I'm aware that I could be deluded about that. But I found myself absolutely in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered the names. I think I might even still remember the names.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the dance at the end,
mm-hmm.
which before you'd never have me dancing. I couldn't dance. It was too much putting my persona on display.
So that feeling of being seen that inhibits, the feeling of self-consciousness that one is being seen, one is being judged, therefore one has to perform, that's also the thing that I want to be free of, and that I do experience myself as progressively more free of. The anxiety, and we talked about some social anxiety right from the start that evening. Because, not really it's a because, but and it is fundamental to, well, we could say the process, we want to be neutral and positive even about it, the process of individuation, going through the gauntlet of social anxiety.
Yes.
Why? I mean, so you're talking about the fear, being fearless because you don't have a persona to present or defend or protect, the ego that is constantly seeing the world as an opportunity to validate itself in some way, or to empower itself, or to define itself.
Yes.
Therefore also sees the world as a threat, because if it can do that, it can do the opposite. What the Lord gives, the Lord takes away.
Yes.
What Caesar gives, Caesar takes away. You're deserving, well done. Yeah, thumbs up, thumb down. If you believe and accept the blessing of the world, then you're also going to be vulnerable to accept its condemnation.
Yes.
Terrifying situation. That's the world. But it only works because we've been imprinted with that original programming of good and evil, like an artificial, arbitrary definition of good and evil.
Yes.
Through bad parenting. I'm doing quotes because maybe there's no such thing as good parenting, and maybe it's not that good or bad. Yes. That's the point. Right?
Yes. But inadequate or adequate parenting is the way it's been phrased recently.
That's the gentler language.
Yes.
Now. Right. So it's not about blaming on the parents. No. I feel like you have to say that now because people immediately, because when you're conditioned with this fight or flight reptilian perceptual mode, when you're stuck in it, the ego, any kind of evaluation of the data, if it's honest, it's going to, in a lot of the cases, or let's say, I would say in all of them, it's going to be pretty dark, it's going to be pretty shocking, and then, so then that perceptual mode condemns.
Correct.
So then it perceives you as condemning simply for saying, this is how my upbringing was. The reaction is often, why are you blaming your parents? Or it's not their fault. Or why are you living in the past?
Yes.
But that's not what we're doing.
It's not what we're doing.
It's kind of the opposite.
It is exactly the opposite.
Right.
Yeah. The challenge of moving forward, it's in a, kind of defining the moving forward.
Yeah.
Can I say that?
Can you say what?
Yeah, it's a defining moving forward in a sense.
Mm.
Is removing the persona or the notion that the ego is there, or the place of the ego as the arbitrator of how we're going to live our life, right? So we allow the ego to define who we are, and that's going to be fear-based because you've defined it perfectly, which is the ego is on unstable territory. It's on sandy ground.
Put your dreams away for now. I won't see you for some time. I am lost in my mind. I get lost in my mind. Mama once told me you're already home when you feel love. I am lost in my mind. I get lost in my mind.
How do we remove the ego? And what is progress? And what is removing the persona? These are... I don't know how to define that. I don't know how to... I don't know where I'm going with that. When I talk with people, and I don't talk with many people about this, oddly enough, especially in the past, because it's my perception that most people are not interested. Mm-hmm. The culture itself has set up this notion of physical gratification and ego gratification as being the ultimate in what you can achieve in life.
Pursuit of happiness.
The pursuit of happiness. The books of wisdom say that that is the pursuit of misery. And if we take a look at the state of the world, for the most part, it seems that the books of wisdom are probably pretty accurate in their assessment that pursuing happiness is going to lead to misery. So removing the ego is a way of experiencing joy.
So I was just checking you'd finished there. You can turn that around and say that experiencing joy is a way to remove the ego too, you know, because of deep relaxation. When in the state of deep relaxation, the ego begins to dissolve because it's a defense posture, if it is. I mean, the kind of ego we're describing. And one of the problems I have is, and not a personal problem, but a problem in communication, dialoguing, is what's the ego and Jung. Yeah, there's all these different terminologies and contexts for ego. So for what we're talking about now is the ego as a constructed identity is a term that I've used more frequently than ego to make it very clear that it's a construction, which I don't know if I have more to qualify there, relating to the defense. It's a structure of defense that was necessary at one time and that is no longer necessary. I'm not sure where we're going now. So you were talking about removal of the ego. So then that, I imagine you will agree with this, so this isn't as a challenge or anything, but that language, I would say, is more the language of the ego itself.
Yes.
That something has to be removed. It so quickly intersects with the deserve and undeserve, good and evil paradigm. The ego is false, therefore it's bad, therefore it must be eradicated, and those who eradicate it deserve, they're the deserving ones.
Yes, there is that trap of language,
which
is again the reconciliation of the opposites, is that the notion of an I, is it possible that a notion of an I can exist without the ego?
Is it?
I'm not sure.
Right. I'm leaning towards no at this time. How are you leaning?
Well, I think that in a way, if the universe is comprised of energy, and if the energy has a sense of awareness to it, then it's possible that the I-ness that I am, right, even as it is constructed in a identity construction, right, will be unique to me. So even as we are trying to, let's say, build an ego or eliminate an ego, the reality is that our methodology is going to be unique to us anyway. We will be naturally expressing who we are. And so then the question only becomes is that if in fact we are naturally expressing who we are, even in the construction of our ego, then does it really matter if the ego exists or not? Because it is who we are anyway.
To which part of us does it matter?
Yes.
To the ego, it really matters.
It does matter.
To get rid of it.
It does.
Because then it will be enlightened and it will be the winner.
Yes.
It will have found its happiness after a lifetime's pursuit.
And it goes back to the Taoist issue of if in fact you want to grasp the truth, then stop trying to grab it.
Yeah. Absolutely. I had a thought and it's gone. So
yeah.
I have to let it just not be there. I can't quite let it go because it's...
We can have time. Is it okay if I chatter around that, or will that distract
you? Keep going.
Okay. So I'm not sure how I want to chatter. One of the things that's for me this joyful thing, or I'm going to go back to the deservedness, and I'm going to be a bit political here because I've political, economic, social, I'm not sure which. Because I see the phrase deservedness being used a lot in our culture. Now, I don't know if it was in the last 10 years or so that it's really become predominant, or that I wasn't aware that it was being used in the way that it was in the past. I'm not sure whether its usage has changed or my awareness has changed. But I became aware of the notion of deservedness as a problem watching a TV show in which a poor school was awarded $10,000 to rebuild its band class because it deserved the money.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me that that's an arbitrary deservedness. And all deservednesses are arbitrary then. How can that particular school that's poor be more deserving than another poor school?
Mm-hmm.
But I expanded it out to the realization that, well, actually wrote in a poem a long time ago, that we find certain creatures on the planet to be annoying.
Yeah.
Malaria mosquitoes. Let's kill them all.
Fleas. Yeah.
Yes.
Cockroaches.
Yeah. We have no problem with killing them because they are annoying.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there's a very funny thing, is that we don't think that they don't deserve to live. We don't put on them, you don't deserve to live.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want you to live. But we don't think you don't deserve to live.
No.
Right? But we do that with people.
Yeah. Well,
and it's an arbitrary distinction. But as soon as you set up a notion of deservedness, I worked hard, so I deserve this.
Mm-hmm.
Then you allow that to say that, well, obviously the person on the street didn't work hard enough, and they deserve to be where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can say that a woman who is a prostitute and a drug addict, well, if she gets raped and murdered, then it's okay, sort of, because obviously she's done something that deserved it. And so we allow people to die from the sake of deservedness. As soon as we accept that there are people who deserve the goodness of the world, we have also accepted that there are people who will deserve that badness.
Of course, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And where it becomes a personal challenge is if, in fact, we allow our inadequate child-rearing practices to keep within us or harbor within us a notion of what can I do to deserve love or respect or these things, then we've already trapped ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because that issue of seeking that deservedness means that we've already don't have the deservedness. You need to shed it.
Mm-hmm.
If in fact you're going to allow the ego to express itself naturally, gracefully, and then slowly allow it to just be a quiet part of our existence and not the forefront of our existence.
Mm-hmm. So religion, the idea of a loving God, an all-loving God, is like an attempt, a very poor attempt, I would say, to try and address that, as in God loves us all, we're all equal in God's sight. That's the theory.
Yes.
The practice, of course, is you have to obey God's rules, otherwise you go to hell. So it's the same program simply running.
Yes.
And in fact, you could even see there's a religious basis for the whole deserve, not deserve ideology.
Yes, you can. And it's probably whether, I don't want to say it's overtly designed to maximize the financial remuneration of the church, i.e. to manipulate people into giving their money.
Mm.
But if you take a look at Christ's basic teachings, is that I don't think Christ at a fundamental level saw anyone as deserving or undeserving.
Mm-hmm.
In his teachings and his practices, he treated all people equally.
Based on a reading in the Gospels, you mean?
Yes, right. He didn't have any problem going and mingling with the beggars, and he didn't have any problem with dealing with the prostitutes, and he didn't have any problem dealing with the lepers. To him, they were all the same.
At a social level, but he did condemn Pharisees and bankers.
Yes, he did condemn the bankers.
Yeah.
Well, I guess he's not perfect either.
There are different criteria, because I don't think that you would be proposing with this argument a complete abandonment of discrimination or discernment.
There's a difference between seeing what is and
condemning it,
and
or judging.
And judging.
Value judgment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, because I was talking with someone recently about tolerance and how we're all told to be tolerant in today's world, but actually that ideological push for tolerance is itself highly intolerant.
Yes.
And part of that is that intolerance is a necessary part of our functioning, biologically and psychologically. So I'm very intolerant of dishonesty.
Yes.
Or superficiality, or somebody wishes to manipulate me, and I don't want to make it about me necessarily, because it's easy to be intolerant of stuff that we don't personally like. But anyway, just the idea that we do need to be able to see and recognize behaviors, or in ourselves and in others, that are, choose your word, like we've reached that point where you have to be very careful what the word is.
Yes, right?
Because you're not going to say evil. We know we've ruled that one out,
yeah.
But we can go all new age and say inauthentic. I don't even particularly like that.
Don't like that one at all.
So really difficult. Inappropriate, of course, sounds a bit snooty.
Yes.
That's inappropriate behavior, but that's probably one of my preferred ones in terms of just accurate.
You could say bad. That would be a George Carlin way of doing it. Stop using the polysyllabic words to describe a bad behavior.
Mm-hmm. So the underlying point being that to see and recognize a behavior that's inappropriate, bad, whatever, unhealthy, doesn't require condemning it.
No.
Doesn't require expunging it or punishing it.
No.
Because that reinforces it.
Correct.
So when you're talking about this in terms of the economic system and all that, which I think is very interesting, I like if we can go macro, but my, I won't say comfort zone, but my area of confidence is always micro.
Okay.
And it equally applies as within, so without, to one's own behaviors, that one, the tendency is to say, to evaluate one's behavior and say, this was good behavior, and I'm being rewarded by this. Say, I did a good podcast, I got lots of comments, ooh, I feel good. Or even now, we're having a conversation, oh, I made a good point, Guy looks happy. I reward myself, I give myself a little bit of cheese. But the flip side of that is when it's not working, the opposite, and I give myself an electric shock. So even at that very basic level of self-examination, the tendency to self-evaluate would interfere with the clear, clean evaluation.
Yes.
If we're using the examination as a reward and punishment thing to feel good about ourselves.
You're absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And for myself, and I am not speaking as a wise person or anything like that, but as for myself, because of where I came from, it was so broken. And so heavily into the deserving, undeserving, and the reward and punishment method of life, is that the experiencing of joy, go back to the joy, is to become aware of the world with acuity.
What's acuity?
Clear-sightedness. And to be aware of yourself, as well. The tricky bit is that when you're being inauthentically aware, I'll say, right? You think you know yourself, because we go through life thinking that we know ourselves pretty well,
mm-hmm.
and that we can fix other people because we have enough knowledge about them as we stumble along.
Right.
That the universe, in a trickster kind of way, will quietly hit you across the side of the head on a regular basis when you're in fact being inauthentic.
So I'm going to pause you there, because the universe is a big word.
Yes.
It's a big concept. So what do you mean by the universe?
The universe. What I mean by the universe in this case here is your interaction with the real world will make it clear to you whether or not you are being authentic or inauthentic.
So I'm going to have to pause you again. What's the unreal world?
The unreal world is, for example, a good example would be, okay, I'm not practicing my spiritual practice. I do my meditation on a daily basis. And I attend the lectures of my guru on a regular basis. And I read all the proper books.
This is you representing
the
unreal. Okay.
Yeah, okay. And so this person here has now decided they've done all the right things. Right? And so they decided that because they've done all the right things, the universe is going to align with themselves, and so they're not going to have any problem. And so, for example, let's do something silly, is that they could say, well, I don't have to look to maintain my car anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm spiritually aware, and the universe is a spiritual place, and so I don't have to check the pressure of my tires.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right? Well, you'll get a flat tire.
And so that, I mean, and I don't think it's necessarily where you're going, but that creates this illusory separation between the person and the universe,
yes.
As in they're going to an infantile state where they're basically just being taken care of,
yes.
By the universe, as opposed to embodying the universe to surrender to it and recognizing,
yes.
That they are the universe.
That they are.
So that brings me back to the question of what is the universe? Because when you say the universe there, I was hearing psyche.
Yes. For me, the universe includes the psyche.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, the universe is a big place.
But does the psyche include the universe?
Yes,
yeah.
It does. You can't have them one or the other. I mean, they're, how's it phrased? They're opposite sides of the same coin.
Right. So you're talking about the physical universe, so-called, I mean, as in the physical reality of the,
yes.
Universe that we can agree about with our five senses.
Correct. But also beyond that, it's the universe as a responsive energy to what we are doing.
And wouldn't that then be psyche?
We could say that. I may have actually kind of accepted that in the past, but I've now think that it's more than that. I think that psyche is also energy.
Well, that's why I said, wouldn't that be psyche?
Yeah, but it's...
I mean, I know the universe is energy too, so then it's probably a false dichotomy.
Yes.
And yet, experientially, it isn't, because we don't know where the psyche is. We can't touch it or measure it or talk about it, hardly. But the universe, we can. I mean, we start here. There's a desk, there's a pen,
yes.
There's a laptop. That's the universe.
Yeah, and the cool thing about the universe, just to be a bit of a devil's advocate here, is that even though we can see the pen and we can touch the table, is that when it's looked at closely, there's nothing there.
So they say, though, but we can't verify that. You know what
well,
I mean? So, because when you talk about the,
yes.
Real world and we say the physical,
yes.
Universe, you know, so you know where I'm
going exactly
with that.
Right. And you're absolutely correct.
Mm.
Right, so it's more of a conceptualization of the possibility that the matter that we see and feel and touch and taste and smell is, in fact... just energy, right? That's a concept.
Yeah.
Right? And there's been some experiments that prove that to be the case, but they're kind of esoteric and
mm-hmm.
hard to fit into a small living room conversation. So, yeah, when I say universe, I'm actually, in my own mind, when I say universe, I've expanded my concept of universe beyond the physical. It comprises the spiritual and the mental and all the rest of it. The whole... way I've been experiencing life in the last 10 or 15 years is that when it's time for me to become more aware, and at that time I'm not aware that I need to be more aware, because whenever I'm at, I figure that I'm aware enough, because obviously I'm functioning, I go to work and
mm-hmm.
I talk with people, and sometimes I'm liked and sometimes I'm disliked, and it seems to be a process. But it seems that with each step along the way, at some point along the way, there is, and how is it put, compulsion. The problem of compulsion, why does we do things, is a great mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And also to the issue of of our awareness is a great mystery. How can we be aware? But somehow there is awareness, and I have no idea what that means, really.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point along the way, in the path of my existence anyway, is that when I've become at a stage of my own development, whether that's emotional, psychological, spiritual, physical, or whatever it happens to be, or a combination of them, is that things need to change. Something presents itself in my world, in my immediate physical experience,
mm-hmm.
that prompts me or pokes me or puts me in a direction to change,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, this is a very difficult concept in a sense. It requires two things for that to be real. It requires that, one, I'm open to the possibility of change, which I've come to the conclusion most people are not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm paraphrasing Jung here when he says that the human animal is torpid, is what he actually, that's a quote, I think, or translated quote.
Mm-hmm.
My paraphrase of that is that most people would rather die than change.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if you become willing to change, what happens is the universe seems to have an understanding of that or awareness of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings people, it brings events, it brings circumstances into your existence that give you the opportunity to embrace change.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're unpleasant, right? When I say that, it makes it sound like it's a kind of a rosy thing. The universe has no qualms, or the universe around me, of making it frickin' messy and stinky and dirty and hard and horrible, right?
Mm-hmm.
It sees no difference there, I don't think. Mm-hmm. To it, it's just an opportunity to become aware.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't see bad things as bad and doesn't see good things as good. It's just what it is.
Right.
What happens is that, this going back to the joy part of it is that once I became aware of this joy and where it was resting in me, is that my ability to react to the opportunities that the universe presents itself has changed a great deal. At one time, I would have gnashed my teeth at certain things and been very upset and wanted to go to bed at night and hope that I wouldn't wake up in the morning and various things like that. But what's happened is that I now recognize that it doesn't really matter. It's all the same kind of thing.
Right.
And the joy comes from allowing the experience simply to be, without a notion of it being good, bad, or hurtful or not hurtful, mm-hmm. just as an opportunity to expand your awareness.
Mm-hmm.
But what is awareness?
And does it need to expand?
And so why is that feeling of awareness and expansion a part of who we are? Right? We can say this to people, you know, well, I've become aware. And to people who are becoming aware, it's hard to define,
mm-hmm.
but you don't have to define it. They're aware of what it means.
Mm-hmm.
To people who are not aware, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, it might mean something that it's not. Might yes. also mean being more informed,
yes,
more knowledgeable.
Having read more books or more magazines or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah.
And
because awareness suggests an object, as in aware of.
Yes.
So, but what you're describing is being aware of awareness.
Yes.
Being aware of being awareness.
Correct. And that's a different thing, and it's very hard to describe. But it changes how you see things.
And how you experience them.
And how you experience things.
Because how you respond to things experiences how they are, in fact.
Yes.
It's like a relationship. What I say to you influences what you then respond and so on. There's
correct.
A dialogue. It's inevitable.
I mean, yes,
there can't be, even though you and I are separate physically, psychically we don't really know, but in terms of a dialogue, we're having a dialogue, we can't separate that just because I'm speaking and then you're speaking. If it's a real dialogue, then I'm losing a sense of what I want to say independently of what you're expressing. There's a symbiosis there.
Yes.
So, and when you were talking earlier about whatever you're talking about, what I was experiencing, I think it was the universe interacting with us, was a becoming more permeable.
Yes.
I think you were talking about being open to change, I think it was.
Yes.
And that my experience, in quotes, because it's a bit too mysterious to say that it's actually an experience, but it's whatever. It's how I'm going to try and describe it, is becoming more permeable so that, maybe so that is not the right beginning of that. But there's less resistance to my environment. So my environment is permeating. The outside is permeating through the inside.
Yes.
So it's informing.
Correct.
My internal experience. And, I know I was going somewhere with this, that has to do with the psyche and the body. So when, if the body and the psyche are out of alignment, but wary now because it's a bit of a model.
Yes.
So I don't want to just refer back to an old model, because this is experiential. But I'm going to have to a little bit, that as the psyche begins to realign with the body, the very things, that prevented the psyche from being aligned with the body in the first place are being gently pushed out, if it's time. Like, the psyche won't force it. But if there's an opening, the psyche moves closer.
Yes.
And then if there's then a little more of an opening, closer again.
Yes.
And so that can be very disruptive.
Very
to
disruptive.
The mind and to the ego. That can be like, feel like a living hell some of the time.
It can be disruptive in every possible way. It can mean breaks up relationships. It means quitting your job. It means climbing a mountain. It could mean everything. For me, one of the key points, or one of the, what I remember back as a key change point, if you want to call it, or a turning point in the I Ching language, was in the early 1990s for me, is I was reading a lot of Carl Jung, and I began to embrace the idea that I had to change, or wanted to change, or more openly I was changing, even though I'd been changing all along, and that I needed to make a leap, and that leap was to embrace the trickster.
Mm-hmm.
And so I needed to allow the trickster into my life in order to embrace life. Mm-hmm. And that scared the shit out of me. Because the trickster, you have absolutely no idea what that's going to bring.
So that's liminality, apparently. Liminality as a stage relates to trickster. The trickster is kind of the archetype of liminality.
Yes.
Pulling the rug out from under.
Yeah, the psychopomp or the Hermes.
The travels between worlds.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. And so I very, very consciously and very... I said, okay, if I'm going to take this path, I need to embrace the trickster. Because I'd been reading about it a fair bit, and I began to understand that in order to be alive, you had to, in fact, have that energy in your life. Whereas up until then, I had pretty much blocked it out for various reasons, fear being a big part of it, the ego fear, and other things. And so I embraced the trickster. And the first thing that the trickster did was publicly put myself into a somewhat humiliating position within my work environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, that's the way it is, and okay. And that was okay with me.
So what does it mean to you then, the trickster? I mean, not in terms of the effects, and because you've already talked about that, or the purpose, but where is it coming from?
Where is it coming from?
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of like, in a way, asking, you know, where is awareness coming
from?
Who
created God?
Right. But as to the role of the trickster, you described it perfectly, which is the messenger between the gods and humans.
Mm-hmm.
But more personally, it's the energy that connects perhaps our psyche to our body and our psyche to its connection to the environment around itself, both on an emotional and physical way. It allows the permeability, right? It's that energy that moves between, well, people, between the world around us, and allows the pathways between our inner chambers or our inner divisions, or however you want to model the human mind. It allows those things to start connecting. That's how I see it anyway. And it began to be true. It took a long time for that, I think, to bear fruit of moving to the state of joy. So it was in the 1990s that I embraced the trickster as an important part of my path. But it wasn't until 2014 that I actually recognized that I had begun to feel joy. Right.
So I understand the trickster a little bit, because it's such a powerful archetype.
Yes.
I mean, to a lot of people, the idea of it and all that. Is there a trick? Is it really? Is the trickster really a trickster, and are we really being tricked?
Now, do you mean, when you say, are we really being tricked, you mean tricked by the trickster? Or tricked by what?
Well, I guess if you answer that yes, we really are being tricked, then you can answer by what. But you may say no. I mean, I feel that we're not being tricked. I think it's a trick that we're being tricked.
Yes, I'm going to go with you on that one. It's a trick that we're being tricked. But the trickster is it's a language, of course, or a word that's used to define the way in which the energy, and that's going to sound funny, the way the energy of the universe, I know you don't like that phrase particularly.
No, it's okay. I just wanted to. Yeah. I'm thinking the way the, my listeners sometimes as well.
The way the universe, and this is going to sound really funny, I don't know how to say this. The energy of the universe speaks in metaphor that's based in humor. Everything about the universe it does as a practical joke.
So that, you know, that's a huge statement.
It is a huge statement.
It's not original, or it's an old one. But, okay, because even if you said joke, it would have been less huge. But you've even got practical joke in there, which is like a prank.
Yes.
So that's even more than a trick.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, not that it matters what I think particularly, but I'm with you up to humor. And then I would want to unpack, like, what is that? What is humor? But then if you go to practical joke, but I'm not going to stop you, so carry on anyway. Like, what do you mean by practical joke?
What do I mean by practical joke? Is I'm going to say that the practical joke part of it is the, if you want to, I'll go back to your way of putting it, is that the trick of it not being a trick, in a sense, right? So the idea that it's not a trick is kind of a trick.
Well, the idea that we think it's a trick, is a trick.
Is kind of the practical joke. The reality in my experience is that as I've been able to disengage my, I'll call it, ego entanglements with how I want things to be, or how I would like them to be as they reflect on me or reflect from me, and I step back and I recognize that the events in my life, and sometimes the choices that I make in my life, or sometimes the choices the people around me make, leads to the most comical and humorous methodologies of self-awareness. The universe seems to want you to become aware of yourself through humor. So when I said I embraced the trickster, and then I proceeded to get an opportunity to be totally embarrassed, it was through a very, very simple and silly thing. And in a TV series, it would be a comedy sketch. And I've now recognized that almost all of my best learning opportunities, for the most part, have some element of humor or direction towards humor. Sometimes they're out and out funny, but sometimes they're not funny per se, but there's an element of humor to them.
So I was thinking when you're saying that humour and fear are almost opposites, as in when one is laughing, well, it's almost like the opposite of being afraid.
Yes.
Total relaxation, isn't it? Bubbling up.
Yes.
Relaxation, active, almost like active relaxation, yes, in a sense. Body expressing in the most free way. And then I was remembering how, a long time ago, it doesn't matter when I was writing a book, I was coming up with opposites for the seven deadly sins, and with anger I had trouble. What's the opposite of anger? And finally I settled on humour.
It's a good opposite for anger. Actually, that is a very good opposite for anger. And actually, that does make a lot of sense, because one of the key parts of my own growth has been the elimination of anger out of my body.
Mm.
Mind and body.
Mm.
I've recently become aware of that, and that there's a perception that there's a separation between the psyche and the body, right? We like to compartmentalize as part of a large logical brain. We like to compartmentalize things, and our emphasis on science and the assignment of space and categories and various other things allows us to compartmentalize. But one of the things I've become aware of with the in the last couple of years, especially with my beginning to practice yoga and meditation on a regular basis, is that the body also stores those emotions.
Mm.
So I have been working on removing anger from my existence for a long time, and perhaps even, I'll have to think about this now that you brought this up, I'll look back on my embracing the trickster as a key step towards allowing that anger to go away. Right?
Mm.
Even through some of the mythology of the trickster characters, quite often there are anger elements within the trickster stories themselves. People are angry about this or that, and the trickster comes in.
The trickster makes people angry. Mm.
And
being laughed at is,
yes,
really hard for the ego.
Yes.
On the other hand, if we're angry, indignant kind of anger, that is really ego-based anger, tends to be a really destructive anger, I should say, otherwise it's circular. It relates to self-importance.
Yes.
And if we can laugh at ourselves, then that cancels out that.
And yes. And that's exactly where I'm going with this. And so what happens is that now with the this awareness is that I recognize now that part of my recent journey has been to remove the remnants of anger from my cells, from my actual physical body.
Mm.
When I first started yoga up in 2014, shortly after I experienced the realization of joy, is that very intuitively when I started doing the yoga seriously, is I recognized that the places in my body where I was stiff and sore and couldn't move properly was where I had in fact been depositing my anger and my pain and shame and various other things. And so part of my meditation and yoga practice is to embrace those areas in my body that are disenfranchised, if I'll call it that, and to honor that feeling and then to let it go. And so you talked about the permeability of things, and this has really become very true to me, is that even as I'm now aware that the universe, in a sense, that my world around me is aware enough of me to present me with the opportunities to learn, at the same time, the permeability applies to my own personal sense of being, in that the psyche, the mind, the body, and the spirit, if you want to call it that, all seem to be moving more or less towards one expression.
Hmm.
There really is no division. I mean, we can point to the skin and we can poke someone's eye, and that's true enough. But the reality is that eye is also connected to the psyche, and it's also connected to the spirit, and the two are not broken up in the way that our science and our thought and our culture has it stated.
That is the end of the first part of my 2-hour conversation with Guy Ndubuho. You can find out more about Guy and read some of his poetry and commentary at the link in the show notes. Part two of this conversation will be up the following Wednesday, the 20th of January. The promised part, second part of my conversation with Ashley Horsey, was not posted due to personal reasons. I would like to thank donators in the past week. That's John D, Elizabeth F, and Stephen A. Thank you so much for supporting this venture and adventure in which we are collectively participating. Until next week, just mostly liminalist.
Wouldn't you get to figure out did you know about bearing this free will compatible with sensors, building blocks? Did you know that much appropriate sour uncle cream is making you tall? Wouldn't you like to figure out what's making us howl? Figure out what's been